Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. A remote indigenous community adjusting to a permanent worldwide blackout must find a new means to survive. That's the plot of Wabgeshig Rice's latest novel, Moon of the Falling Leaves. The story extends the setting of his first novel and drives home the value of traditional connections when the worst-case scenario happens. We'll talk with a First Nations writer about finding hope in a dystopian storyline and what Native writers can teach us about literature. The conversation starts after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Events took place across the country over the weekend to raise awareness of missing and murdered Indigenous people. Some events are continuing Monday, including a walk hosted by the Yurok tribe in California. The tribe has declared an emergency on its reservation in response to disproportionate numbers of MMIP. The tribe works year-round on the issue. Earlier this year, the tribe co-hosted a summit in Sacramento and a march around the California state capitol. Philip Williams is a Yurok tribal council member.
This issue, you know, we were dealing with this. We were having some of our people being kidnapped, and we had a rash of murders that showed up on our reservation, people that I know, and we all agreed we had to do something about it.
One of those things was creating the summit.
I think one of the biggest effectiveness of this summit is that us Indian people get together. And so we're trying to raise awareness and say, we're here, and we need to be valued. Our lives need to be valued, and we need opportunities to succeed.
Danielle Vigil Mastin is an advocate and works on MMIP issues with North Coast California communities. She joined families, tribal leaders, law enforcement, and others at the summit, saying it's vital to continue to raise awareness.
If we don't talk about these cases and share their stories and keep it alive, then it's like it just goes away. It's like it doesn't exist. And people out of sight, out of mind, you know, that's why we put billboards up. That's why we educate people. That's why we put signs everywhere. Back in the old days, they used to have the milk cartons that everyone would see when they ate cereal. Now it's Facebook. And so we just try to get that out there. These types of events are really important.
Raising awareness of MMIP includes educating policymakers about the history of California Native Americans and the impacts of colonization, says Morningstar Galley, Director of Indigenous Justice.
We're right here at the state capitol, where the state of California was founded on the state-sanctioned murder and genocide of California Native peoples. Close by is what is known as Sutter's Fort, where it was our Miwok, Nisenan, and Maidu tribal peoples that built the fort. They were enslaved there. They were held captive. And so recognizing that this capital right here behind us put bounties on our heads, recognizing the history of California and how that still continues to affect us today.
Officials say MMIP is going in the wrong direction in the state, with cases going up instead of down, which is concerning tribal leaders who vow to continue to raise awareness and seek solutions. Joseph L. James is chairman of the Yurok tribe.
California is, unfortunately, we are the fifth largest cases of MMIP in the nation. We're trying to say no more, lawmakers. Hear us, see us, not on our watch, not in California's watch, not Indigenous watch. There's a crisis in California, but this is not a California issue, this is a nation issue. And again, we're trying to ring that bell by bringing them to the table.
Leaders and advocates say there's still much work to do, including healing for families and tribal communities. This story is a collaboration with First Nations Experience Television with support from the Public Welfare Foundation. The U.S. Justice Department recognized May 5th as National Missing or Murdered Indigenous Persons Awareness Day. In recognition, Attorney General Merrick Garland said there's much work to do by the agency to tackle MMIP and human trafficking in American Indian and Alaska Native communities. In a statement, he said the day challenged the Justice Department to double down on efforts and to be true partners with tribal communities. The agency highlighted a MMIP outreach program to assist with unresolved cases and related crimes, promote communication, coordination, and collaboration among federal, tribal, local, and state law enforcement. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Drummond Woodsum, a full-service law firm whose nationally recognized tribal nations practice provides services to tribal nations and their enterprises and to companies that do business with tribes across the country. More at dwmlaw.com.
Support by BNSF Railway, proudly supporting the nation's economy by moving the goods that feed, supply, and power communities across the country. More at bnsf.com/tribal relations.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. 10 years after a blackout that caused a societal collapse, a remote Anishinaabe community has been living off the land much like their ancestors did. But now, with plant life dying and dwindling food sources, a group is formed to trek further south through the wilderness to find a new home. Unsure of what they will find on their journey, they face obstacles, hardships, and surprises. This is the setting of the new book, Moon of the Turning Leaves, by acclaimed Anishinaabe author and journalist Wabgishig Rice. The book is a sequel to 2018's Moon of the Crusted Snow. Today on our show, we'll talk with Wabgishig about his new novel, published this year by HarperCollins. And later in the hour, we'll hear about legendary Sac and Fox athlete Jim Thorpe posthumously receiving the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Join today's conversation with comments or questions by calling 1-800-996-2848. That number connects you directly with our Albuquerque, New Mexico studio, 1-800-996-2848. You can also comment on our website or social media pages. Joining us now from Sudbury, Ontario, is Wabgishig Rice. He is an author and a journalist and also a former radio show host. He is Anishinaabe from Wasasing First Nation. Hello, Wab. Welcome to NAC, and great to have you back on the show, brother.
Hey, Sean. Thanks a lot for having me, Miigwech. It's just an honor and a delight to be here with you.
Well, congratulations. You thoroughly succeeded me, Wab, in tapping into one of my worst fears, and probably many of our listeners too, a total collapse of society, leaving every man and woman and child to fend for themselves. Is that your goal, just to freak everybody out?
Yeah, that's part of the goal, you know. Like, the fun in making up stories and having the opportunity to write them is to really just tap into human feeling, right? And the big part of that is trying to freak people out, you know? You know, and that, like, tests your own individual, I think, fears, too. I obviously would be pretty freaked out by, like, a total collapse of civilization. And I don't know how well I'd fare out there without all of our luxuries and technologies and all that. But yeah, you know, at the core, though, I just want people to look inward a bit, you know, think about how they want to support their families, their communities in response to a collapse. And, you know, how our ancestors as Indigenous people have dealt with that over and over, and how they've sort of picked up the pieces and put them back together and tried to make good, positive, healthy, happy, safe spaces for the generations to come. So those are some of the things I tried to tap into there, and I'm glad it works for some people anyways.
Yeah. Well, tell me more about your vision for the book. It's a really exciting topic, very, very intriguing, but it's one that's been written about many times before. What was different about your approach?
Yeah, well, the idea for the first book, for Moon of the Crested Snow, came up quite a long time ago. It was actually in the summer of 2003. Some of your listeners may remember the great Northeast blackout of 2003, when the power went out for something like 55 million people in parts of the U.S. and parts of Canada, hitting big cities like Toronto, Ottawa, Boston, Cleveland, New York, Detroit, and so on, right? I was actually on the res that day that that happened. I was with my two younger brothers. We were house-sitting for our dad and stepmom, who were away on summer holidays. And it was really mysterious, right? Like, all of a sudden, the power went out on this sunny summer day. And my brothers and I were like, yeah, that's kind of weird, but we didn't think too much of it. until the afternoon went on and the power didn't come back on, right? So we got in the car and we drove to nearby Parry Sound, Ontario, which is a town about 10 minutes away. And we saw the power was out there too. And we're like, okay, this must be a big deal. And we heard through a friend that we saw downtown that it was this huge blackout, right? And we started getting scared because we thought it was a big one. We're like, oh, it's hitting the fan now. This is the apocalypse, right? So we went back to the res and we started making like a survival plan. And then we started thinking about all the people around us who were resourceful, people who, you know, knew how to hunt, you know, could fish well, could gather medicine from the bush and so on. And these are all our friends and family members, right? And we grew up with that knowledge too. And, you know, we just thought, well, if there's any place to be for the end of the world, it's the res, because we don't need power or nothing like that, right? We can make things work. And that moment really stuck with me. And I just thought of that community response to this crisis and how we came together. And in a lot of like post-apocalyptic literature, you see like one or two people going it alone, right? Like the hero just trying to like save the day for, you know, himself or like a small group of people or whatever. But I wanted to do things differently when Moon of the Crescent Snow was sort of forming in my mind. I wanted to show that resilience of Indigenous people and also like the gifts that we have within our own communities of living off the land, of hanging on to the knowledge that our ancestors passed down to us, and really the sacrifices those ancestors made to ensure that we still have those really important, you know, gifts of identity and culture and language and so on today, right? So that's really where the idea for Moon of the Crescent Snow came out. And it came out in 2018, as you mentioned earlier. And once it was out, the people were really interested in the story and a potential sequel. And that's sort of where the wheels got turning for the sequel. You know, I thought, well, I'll make it in the future so that we can see how, you know, they've formed their new community and society and their new way of life based on Anishinaabe knowledge and land-based living. And that's sort of where Moon of the Turning Leaves came up. And it becomes sort of a quest story, too, as you mentioned, the basic plot, right? And, yeah, here we are, and it's been out, and it's been a fun ride for sure.
I think everybody on some level thinks about the possibility of something like this really happening. And I remember years ago I was dating this girl, and I got into a conversation with her dad about what a dystopian world might look like, and he was really adamant that Native people would be better prepared than other groups to deal with those consequences. And what I like about your book is that's true in some ways, but in other ways, we're just as vulnerable as everyone else. And, you know, your characters, they're relatable. I mean, they're tough, but they're not superheroes. I mean, they are definitely vulnerable.
Oh, for sure. And I think that's part of capturing that reality of you know, our everyday experiences. And I think as an Indigenous writer, I feel like it's my responsibility, it's my job to humanize Indigenous people, to show what our day-to-day realities are as an Anishinaabek and beyond. And part of that is like showing that not everybody has all the answers, right? Not everybody has all the tools or all the expertise to, you know, make the transition that these people need to do at the end of their world, you know? So yeah, like it's just really tapping into the diversity within our own communities, right? And, you know, we're not a monolith as Indigenous people. We are all made up of different sort of backgrounds, have different hopes and dreams and so on. And yeah, that's part of what I was trying to capture there in the sort of cross-section of the community I was trying to portray.
Well, tell us more about these, you know, the key characters, and what, there's six of them that embark on this journey south to find a better place to live.
Yeah, for sure. So it's the sort of main character is Evan Whitesky, and he's the main character from the first book. In the first book, he's a young dad. His partner, he and his partner Nicole, are raising two little kids, a boy named Mayangun and a girl named Nungos. And he's very much taking on a role of leadership in the community in the immediate aftermath of the blackout in the first book. And he sort of helps, you know, bring everybody together and overcome the challenges that they're faced with, right? With these invaders coming into their community and with the ongoing difficulties of the blackout and so on. So in the second book, he's very much there again, And because he's, you know, carried on sort of a leadership role, you know, and he's like a reluctant leader, right? He's a pretty humble guy, but he's sort of tasked with leading this mission to the south to find, you know, a new place to live. And Nungos, his daughter, his 15-year-old daughter, she's, you know, come into her own as a leader too. And she's an expert archer. She knows how to hunt better than most of the other youth in the community. She has, you know, superior bush skills in terms of like gathering medicine and just knowing how to go through the bush and so on. So
she's a BA. She's a BA.
Yeah, exactly. She is a BA. Yeah. And it was cool, you know, thinking of her that way and being able to like, you know, have her emerge as a BA. Right. That was hugely fun. So yeah, she's right there too. There's a character from the first book named Tyler, who's one of Evan's best buddies, and he's there for part of the quest too. Another older guy named JC, who plays a pretty minor role in the first book, but he emerges as one of the I guess elderly kind of figures in the second book on this mission. And then there's a young couple too, Cal and Amber, who you know, have grown up much like Nungos. They're a little bit older than her, but they've grown up like her in this new era of land-based living, and they have skills to bring on the journey, too. So that's the six of them that make this trek.
All right. We are talking with Wob Rice about his new novel, Moon of the Turning Leaves. It was just published earlier this year with HarperCollins. And I read it this weekend, and I really enjoyed it. It freaked me out at points. It's definitely an eye-opening, startling commentary on what could ultimately happen here. In the United States, in Canada, of course, where the book is initially set, or what was once Canada. Of course, this is a dystopian world we're talking about. But if you've had a chance to read this book, give us a call. Tell us what you think. Tell us if you think it's an accurate portrayal or representation of what a dystopian world might look like and how Native people would respond in that type of an environment. Give us a call. We've got the phone lines open, 1-800-99-NATIVE. Tell us your thoughts, tell us your perspectives, or if you've read any recent dystopian books and you just kind of think about that topic and it concerns you ever, if it ever keeps you up at night worrying about what something like that might look like, give us a call, share your perspectives. We'd really like to know what your thoughts are on this issue. We're going to take our first break here, and when we come back, we're going to talk more with Wob Rice about this new book. There's a small number of ultra-wealthy tribes that run a little differently than others. Their wealth, mostly from gaming, presents a unique set of challenges and opportunities. Does more money mean more problems? We'll discuss on the next episode of Native America Calling.
My name is Tammy, and I'm a member of the Little Traverse Bay Band of Odawa Indians. Smoking gave me heart disease. I used to think of cigarette smoking as something that only affected me. Then at just 44 years old, I had to look into my mom's eyes on the way into emergency heart surgery and tell her, "Mommy, I promise I won't make you bury me." My tip is, think about the people in your life who love you. They go through the pain too, maybe even more than you do.
The people you love are worth quitting for. You can quit. For free help, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. A message from the CDC.
Thank you for listening to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. We are speaking with author Wobgishig Rice about his new book, Moon of the Turning Leaves. Did you read Moon of the Crusted Snow, the novel that this sequel is based on? Join our conversation with a comment or question at 1-800-996-2848. And a reminder, you can listen back to this show and past shows on all major podcast platforms such as Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And you can listen to other types of Native programming by downloading the NV1 app to your smart device. We've got a caller on the line right now, Raquel, listening online in Los Angeles, California. Good morning, Raquel.
Good morning. Happy to be calling in.
Great to have you on the show. Did you get a chance to read Moon of the Turning Leaves yet?
Not yet, but I'm going to read it on the one before it now.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, what do you want to say to Wob?
Just real quick, because I'm at work. We are living in dystopian times right now. It's just different. than most dystopian stories we see. But I just wanted to point that out real quick, because what I'm seeing right now is pretty scary already, and for a lot of people, kind of hopeless. So I'm looking forward to reading this story and seeing how we can write up this apocalypse.
All right, right on, Raquel. Appreciate that call. And Wob, I think our caller Raquel is definitely tapping into what a lot of people are feeling right now. And you know, we're seeing just more conversations about a dystopian future and books and like yours, and then also television shows and movies. And I got to ask you, I mean, do you think Western society is ultimately going to collapse?
Well, you know, I don't have a crystal ball, obviously, but I do want to fully agree with what Raquel is saying about, you know, this being a dystopia already. You know, if you take a look at any native nation, basically anywhere in the world, where the regime that currently exists on top of indigenous nations, wherever it is very much a dystopia. You know, where indigenous nations have been colonized, you know, their ways of life have been brutalized out of them. You know, their languages are in damage and disrepair. In many states, ceremonies, cultural celebrations, gatherings were outlawed, outright forbidden by the state. And right now, we're sort of slowly, up here in Canada anyways, healing from all that. But there's still, like, a lot of damage that lingers, right? So objectively, that's the dystopia for Indigenous nations, you know? Like, our languages are in rough shape. You know, our people are in poorer health than Canadian counterparts. We're still, like, trying to organize politically and economically and so on, like, in the aftermath of, you know, having our land stolen and having our ways of life, like, you know, beaten out of us and so on. So, yeah, it is very dystopian what we've, you know, live in now, and we have already overcome several different kinds of apocalypse as Indigenous peoples. Where it's going, like, it's downright scary, you know, and if you look at the political climate in countries like both Canada and the United States, there's so much strife, so much division that dominates the discourse that you wonder, can people actually form community from different backgrounds, right? It becomes quite disturbing to see all of this animosity arise, you know, and you just wonder, is that going to lead ultimately to a bigger collapse? I like to, you know, try to take a more optimistic outlook of that. And part of what I try to get at in both Moon of the Crescent Snow and Moon of the Turning Leaves is that, you know, we have the resilience to overcome the apocalypse already. You know, our ancestors held on to these things for us so that we could, you know, reignite them someday. And here we are, you know, with the autonomy to be ourselves finally, right, in the 21st century. We're still a long ways to go, obviously, but we've been able to rebuild. So hopefully with that knowledge of our history, that can help us as Indigenous peoples anyway, go forward and try to push back against, you know, whatever other kind of collapse happens, or adapt to it and survive as a result of it, you know? So that's not to say, like, there's a blueprint there for everybody to follow, but I think we do need to recognize our recent histories and what we're capable of as Indigenous peoples.
Absolutely. Let's take another caller. This one's coming in from Saskatchewan in Canada. Macaw, who is listening online. Good morning, Macaw.
Hi. Thanks for this program. And I love the topic. And I think it's right on. I hope a lot of people pay attention to your message and, you know, maybe practice a little bit more food sovereignty and, get back to the land, because no matter what, you know, you got your lifestyle together and you can go through anything that needs to be gone through. And also, some of us are watching the solar flares and that whole magnetic energy. So there is increased and sort of unprecedented activity from the solar flares. And that is what can knock out the grid systems. So I think you're right on track and way to go. I wouldn't call your book dystopian. We're in dystopia here right now.
Oh, geez.
So anyway, that's my comment.
All right, Mukha, thank you for calling in from Saskatchewan. And Wob, this is cool. We've got a lot of listeners up in Canada who want to call in and talk to you. And, we're already in that dystopian world. What else are you hearing from your readers so far in terms of response for the book, and especially Native readers?
Well, I'm glad Macaw brought up food sovereignty, because that was something else that inspired me to look at, you know, how our future could unfold, right? And part of that, you know, came from writing this book in the first couple years of the pandemic. You know, I quit my job at CBC in the spring of 2020, so 4 years ago, which was coincided exactly with the pandemic unfolding, which was like so weird altogether to experience all those things at once, right? But in those first months of the pandemic, like, what we saw a lot of where I live is, you know, the conversations around food sovereignty, because, like, the trains and the trucks weren't bringing food into the supermarkets, right, because everything was locked down. So people started having conversations about, how can we build community gardens, and how can we sustain ourselves with, like, small-scale agriculture and things like that, because we can't always rely on food coming in from elsewhere. And I was like, yeah, that's exactly what I'm trying to get at with these stories, you know. Obviously, you know, things deteriorated over the pandemic, and a lot of conversations got overshadowed by other things, unfortunately. But, you know, we don't have to look too far, as I was saying earlier, for that inspiration, you know. Like, as I said earlier, when I was going through the blackout of 2003, my brothers and I were like, well, we know how to fish, so we're good there. You know, our auntie down the way here, she knows how to make medicine from, like, sumac and dandelions and whatever else. And, like, our uncle over here, you know, he's got a lot of food saved up because he's a good hunter and things like that, right? And these are people who will freely share all these things with everybody, because that's what a community does, you know? And that's, you know, what the essence of food sovereignty from an Indigenous perspective can be. But it's easy to forget these things, right? Because we become so reliant on what's convenient and so on. But I think people from all walks of life, whether you're Indigenous or not, to some degree, we all come from those agrarian backgrounds. You know, we have it in our history that we lived off the land. And it's only been for the past few centuries that almost everybody around the world has been industrialized or become more reliant upon technology, or, you know, these other food delivery systems that make eating and acquiring food easier and so on, right? So I think it's good just to reflect on that and have those conversations and have, like, a plan, because, you know, you never know what could happen next. But it's just, I think a responsibility on behalf of me as someone who has a platform to, I think, recognize, I guess, my position, but also, like, my shortcomings as an individual too, you know. Like, I'm not that good at gardening. My wife is, thankfully. She takes it a lot more serious than I do. But, it's front of mind all the time anyway. So it's good to keep that that conversation going.
Wob, in addition to food sovereignty, Native language is a big part of the book. Talk more about that.
Yeah, well, you know, I grew up hearing my language all around me, hearing Anishinaabemowin. You know, I grew up on the res in the 80s and 90s when I was a kid. But I never learned it fluently as a kid. And you know, that's due to a lot of different reasons. You know, I personally didn't prioritize it as much back then. You know, I didn't try hard to learn it fluently. And, you know, the older generations, you know, didn't share it as much with us as, you know, that intergenerational learning happens today. And of course, I don't fault anybody in my family or in my community for me not becoming a fluent speaker. I blame the country of Canada for what it's done to our people and our communities and our languages for me not becoming fluent, right? Because, you know, the country of Canada tried to erase our language outright, you know, ultimately. And that shame and that damage, you know, lingers across generations. So I'm not a fluent speaker for that reason, but I thankfully have some knowledge, and, you know, I've had that since I was a little kid. It's become more of a priority for me to learn it fluently in adulthood, especially now that I'm a dad. And, you know, we're raising three Anishinaabe boys. So I've taken, like, courses and various other endeavors through my adulthood to learn the language more properly and more fluently. And it was important for me to try to reflect that journey of my own in my books. You know, in my first two books, Midnight Sweat Lodge and Legacy, there is some language in those stories. In Moon of the Crested Snow, you know, my learning advanced quite a bit more, so I wanted to have it, you know, more present in that story. And also, it was a story that had a bit of a wider reach initially, right? And it's just a matter of really representing our language, you know, having Anishinaabemowin there in an English text to show that it's still alive, it exists, it's still being spoken, it's still being heard. And at this moment of great upheaval, you know, it's there for the Anishinaabek in the story to have and to rely upon for their sense of community, sense of self. And in terms of like creating a new dialogue for themselves in the future, you know, so with Moon of the Turning Leaves, because it's set much farther into the future, you know, the goal of this community was, because they had this opportunity to start over, you know, to liberate themselves from the state because of this cataclysm, that they want to fully revive the language. However, they're not quite able to get there because of, like, you know, the ongoing traumas of the blackout and the ongoing traumas of being a colonized people, you know. But they do make improvements. And, you know, my own personal improvements, I wanted to reflect in the story, too. So I wanted to make the language in the story a little more conversational, a little more grammatically advanced. And just to show that, you know, here are Indigenous people who have the sovereignty to dictate their own future now, and they're making language a priority, and they're finding ways to strengthen that language now that they are in total control of their destinies, right? So it was, you know, it's part inspiration, part motivation for me personally, but also, like, a sharing of the potential of what our languages can be for us and for our futures. So I give full credit to, you know, my language teachers. Dr. Marianne Corbier is one of them. She's from Wiklemkong up here. My younger brother, one of my younger brothers, Musqueamquid, he's a language learner. He's doing some great work in revitalization, and some of his peers too. And also, like, just my wider community of people who are encouraged by seeing language in the book and wanting to, you know, participate in that, wanting to engage in it. It's just a really special thing for sure.
I really enjoyed those elements that you included of the language. And I got kind of a little bit of a crash course in Anishinaabe while I was reading your book, and some of the phrases and the names, of course, were really cool. Some of the characters' names. Wob, let's take another phone call. Chanupa, who was listening in Pine Ridge, South Dakota, on Keeley Radio. Hello, Chanupa.
Hey, thank you for this program on language. And the book, the author that talked about his books that he's established and created by putting language, there's one that's never, ever really talked about, you know, talked in the oral realm. It's just the Dull Knives of Pine Ridge. They put a language of our traditional way in that, because long time ago, language is like this, and this is going out to the brother. I hope he answers this question. They say, Wolak hota kilila o techike, cha owa pi bonji, suta woyuk chanle yakuk te hunta, takomani, which ho chakike he chakike. Meaning that if the language is kept like that, and if you put illustrations of it in a book, then it can strive and grow, because some of these meanings for the language is gone. And I want to commend that brother for talking his language and contributing to the realm of writing books, because not only do people don't forget the understanding, they forget to do it. So whoopie that funka to you, Sean, and him for creating this book. Thank you, guys. From
all right.
Ahoo.
Thank you for that phone call, Chanupa. And Wob, feel free to respond to Chanupa. He's in Pine Ridge.
Oh, Chanupa, brother, Chimi Gwech, big thanks for noting that. You know, that really means a lot to have encouragement and to know that the spirit of language support and restoration goes across all our nations, right? That we're all dealing with these struggles of trying to rebuild our languages because of what happened to us by the colonizers, you know? So, and that's an interesting discussion to have too, right? About writing it down, because, you know, as many of us Indigenous nations, we come from what we all call an oral tradition, right? We speak our stories, we speak our languages from generation to generation. And, you know, there's some debate over what you should write down or what you shouldn't, you know? But I think we're coming to a place, and Chinupa rightly mentioned this, that we really need to ensure that it lives on. And I think by any means necessary, we should try to document our languages, you know, to show that they exist not just in like a linguistic realm of teaching language, but in a pop culture and arts realm too, you know? So by putting it in a novel, what I want to do is, you know, have this form of entertainment for people and show this sense of identity that's rooted in language amongst these people that are going on this adventure, you know? And then, you know, some of my peers, you know, in music and theater and filmmaking, they work really hard to include their people's languages in their works too. And we're seeing some really cool things happen, right? Across Indian country of indigenous artists, you know, transposing or adapting their languages into these different art forms and finding ways to do really cool things that are really revolutionary. And, you know, it becomes, you know, a touchstone for us as indigenous people to really be proud and be inspired by these works of art. And that also helps open the door for other communities to come in and learn from us and sort of be inspired to do their own thing and to, you know, rightly proclaim what our languages are and who we are to all outsiders, to all non-Indigenous outsiders, and just show that here we are doing our thing, we're proud of it, and we're creating beautiful things as a result of it.
Wob, we're going to take another break now, and when we come back, we've got another caller who has a comment for you. And we're also going to talk a little bit about Jim Thorpe and him being posthumously recognized with the Presidential Medal of Freedom. So, listeners, stay with us. If you'd like to join the conversation, we've got the phone lines open still, 1-800-996-2848.
Support by Archaeology Southwest. Did you know almost all major archaeological sites in the Southwest have been looted or vandalized? Looting and vandalism impact Indigenous people, past, present, and future. Every day, countless Native American cultural items are lost or damaged forever through looting and vandalism. Federal and tribal laws protect archaeological resources. More information about ending archaeological resource crime and how to submit a tip at savehistory.org and on social media at savehistory.
You're listening to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce, and we are wrapping up our conversation with Wobgishig Rice and his new novel, Moon of the Turning Leaves. In a few moments, we'll also talk about Jim Thorpe receiving the Presidential Medal of Freedom with one of his granddaughters. But before that, we've got a caller on the line, another caller who is listening in New Hampshire. His name is Stephen. Hello, Stephen. You're on the line.
Hey, Sean. Thanks very much. And bonjour. Wob, it's Miigwech for another amazing book. And I just wanted to ask, one of the things that was really striking to me about this book was just the real richness of the visual imagery that you used for the kind of decay that the group is walking through and everything with all the years that have gone by. And I was just wondering if there was anything in particular that you used for inspiration for that that incredibly, you know, rich visuality, or was that just all imagination on your part, or what? But again, thanks so much for a great book.
Great question. Wob, please respond.
Oh, Miigwech, Stephen. I really appreciate your comment, and thanks for taking the time to read the story. Great question. I would say it was a mix of both, you know, like part of it's, you know, thinking about how would, you know, our towns and cities look in the aftermath of a collapse, right? Like a total collapse, you know, people fully vacating, you know, towns and cities, how vegetation would emerge and so on. So there was a bit of research I needed to do in terms of that. And there's a really cool book by Louis Dartnell called How to Rebuild in the Aftermath of a Cataclysm. I think that's what the title is exactly, but it's a Louis Dartnell story. And he, you know, very precisely illustrates, you know, how long it would be until, like, you know, trees are sprouting up through the asphalt, or, you know, buildings are beginning to collapse and so on. So that provided some, like, foundational sort of imagery, I guess, in terms of, like, showing the towns and cities in the book. But also, like, here where I live in Northern Ontario, like, you don't have to go far to find, like, dilapidated surroundings. You know, there are a lot of ghost towns around here. Where I live in Sudbury, it's north of, about an hour and a half north of the reservation where I grew up. And there's a new highway that's been built between both places. So if you go to the old highway, which is still open and operational, you can find all these like abandoned and dilapidated gas stations, restaurants, hotels, houses, and so on. So when I was doing some of like the research for the novel, I just drove up and down the old highway and like parked and, you know, sat outside, you know, took some good mental images of the buildings and like how it smelled with the vegetation coming up and you know, what it sounded like when the wind would blow through and some of these, like, you know, falling boards and shingles or whatever else would, you know, flap in the wind and so on. So, yeah, it was a mix of both. In terms of, like, the land itself, though, I really wanted to make the landscape they're traversing through as engaging an element as possible when I was writing it, because I didn't want it just to be a setting, right? I didn't want it just to be a backdrop. I wanted it to be a force that had an influence on the characters and on the plot itself, much like it would be for, it has been for all of us Indigenous people, wherever we live, right? Like, there's a great reverence and respect for the land, and we engage with it in very meaningful ways. So as this group is walking south through the bush, you know, they're having these moments of reverence and admiration, and they're mindful of their surroundings, and, you know, they pay tribute to it wherever they can, right? So that was important for me to try to illustrate the land in that way, too, and to provide sort of like this juxtaposition of perspectives as to what the land means to us as Indigenous people compared to more recent settlers in our landscapes and so on, right? So, yeah, there was a lot of work that went into that. So thanks for noting that, Stephen.
Wob, for Moon of the Crusted Snow, you actually made a music playlist that was inspired by the book. It included some Nine Inch Nails, A Tribe Called Red. Any thoughts of making a musical playlist for Moon of the Turning Leaves?
Yeah, I'm starting to sort of put that together on sort of my Apple Music account. But I wanted to, I'm glad you brought up music, because I really appreciated that Testament song that you had on earlier, playing it into our conversation. Big Testament fan, so that's deadly. Yeah, I'm starting to think about some songs to put into a playlist. So once I do get that done, I'll share it out on my social media for everybody to take a listen.
All right. In addition to all that, the visuals of, you know, the land and the buildings and everything, you got me freaked out with all those sideways crosses that were written on some of those buildings. And there are elements of white supremacy in the book as well. And if you could, maybe just for a minute or two, just kind of give us a synopsis of how that plays into the whole book.
Yeah, for sure. Well, in the first book, there's like one bad guy, right? His name's Justin Scott. He comes up to the res from the city and tries to take over. And he, you know, manipulates people and so on. And he's like an allegory for colonialism, right? And in the second book, I was like, I'm not going to be able to replicate just one bad guy. I got to think of something else that's going to be the antagonist. So I thought, well, what scares me? And, you know, it's well-armed white supremacists, you know, like dudes who would be roaming the land looking to take over, who have a lot of guns and ammo, you know. So I wanted, you know, to show this future where, you know, it's essentially chaotic. You know, a lot of people have different kinds of opportunities and influence on the land around them and on different people and communities and so on. And this group of militia, essentially, was, you know, catalyzed by the blackout. And they're able to sort of come together and exert their force over the land because they're well-armed and they have those kinds of resources. So, yeah, and the sideways cross, like, it's supposed to be like a cross propped up as kind of like a gun, right? That becomes their symbol. And they call themselves the Disciples, but not, you know, it's sort of a play on the religious connotation. They actually, you know, have faith in the gun and violence, and that's what they use to take control, you know? So it was freaky, you know, to dream up those guys and to do that research. I did a lot of YouTube research, you know, looking up dudes like that who are very present in our modern society now. But at the same time, I think, you know, we can't sort of discredit or discount people who think and feel that way. You know, those attitudes and ideas come from somewhere. And I think we need to find ways to not just confront those, but find ways to, I think, abate them and try to work together for, you know, a more healthy and positive future.
Moon of the Turning Leaves is available on bookshelves now. It's published by HarperCollins. And Wahb, thank you again for joining us, and congratulations. A wonderful book, and just continued success going forward, brother.
Miigwech, brother. Sean, thanks a lot, man. This was so fun to hang out with you this afternoon, and Miigwech to all your callers. This has been a blast.
All right, we'll do it again when you come out with your next book, or hopefully sooner.
For sure. Thanks, brother.
You bet. Let's hear some audio now from a speech by President Joe Biden honoring the late Sac and Fox athlete Jim Thorpe on May 3rd.
Jim Thorpe, a one-of-a-kind champion. I grew up in Scranton, Pennsylvania, hearing from my grandpa. His name was Ambrose Finnegan. And, you know, he was an All-American at Santa Clara playing football back in 1905. And I grew up always hearing about Jim Thorpe. I'm serious. As the greatest athlete, not just the greatest ball player, the greatest athlete of all time. He talked about him all the time. In 1912, he became the first Native American athlete to win an Olympic gold medal. He set world records in the decathlon. He was a professional football player, a professional baseball player, a professional basketball player. Jim Thorpe showcased unparalleled athleticism, and he transcended racial barriers and the power of perseverance, sheer will, and determination. Thank you, Lynn, who is Jim's oldest living grandchild, for accepting this medal on his behalf.
That was President Joe Biden last week talking about the late athlete Jim Thorpe. Joining us now from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, is Anita Thorpe. She is the granddaughter of the legendary Jim Thorpe. She is Sac and Fox. Hello, Anita. It is a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hello. Yes, so I'm in Oklahoma right now, and we're expecting some tornadoes this afternoon, so I may get to leave work a little bit early to go prepare for that.
A tornado. Well, geez. I mean, when I think of your grandfather, I think a lot of people would describe him as being a tornado on the football field and in other athletic competitions. Just congratulations to you and of course, your late grandfather and your whole family. This is a long time coming, and I think a lot of people would say this should have happened sooner.
Oh, yes. So, you know, I was told he was on a list for quite some time now. You know, I wasn't able to verify that, but I don't know what the process is. But I can tell you my father had talked to me several years before he passed away, and he had a stroke, so he wasn't always able to verbalize things. But he said, it was one of his wishes. He said, Anita, would you write the president and ask him, you know, he didn't know what the name of the award was. So I don't think I ever wrote the president like he wanted me to, but I'm pretty sure this is what he was wanting, and this was one of his last wishes before he passed away in 2020.
That's just wonderful. Well, tell us more about how you folks are feeling right now, and what kind of feedback, what kind of reception are you getting across Indian country now that Jim Thorpe, Congressional Medal of Freedom.
Well, you know, my grandfather passed away in 1953, so he's been gone for quite some time, but his children, you know, they spent their whole lives trying to right some of the wrongs, have his medals returned, and just any type of recognition like this Medal of Freedom, Presidential Medal of Freedom, you know, so they, I grew up watching my father, my aunts and uncles all advocate for Jim Thorpe. And so this is a wonderful opportunity. And, you know, it may have been partly due to the IOC restoring his medal 2 years ago in 2022. So this this may have probably laid the path for this this most recent medal.
I think it might, yeah. And we did a show 2 years ago when your grandfather's gold medals were reinstated, and now, of course, the Presidential Medal of Freedom, not the Congressional Medal of Freedom, like I mentioned before. My apologies. And, you know, Anita, I often wonder about the long-term significance of celebrity athletes, especially today. You have people like LeBron James and Serena Williams, and I wonder, In 100 years, are we going to be talking about those people, or will our grandchildren be talking about those people? Will they still be famous? And here it's been more than 100 years since your grandfather won his gold medals, and we're still talking about him. So where do you see his legacy going from here?
Oh, yes. I mean, it's, you know, all of Jim's children, all seven of his children, well, eight, they've all passed. And so now it's the next generation, which would be, you know, me and my cousins, to pick up the torch and make sure people don't forget. You know, even with this Presidential Medal of Freedom, you can look at the long list of recipients, and you're not going to find very many Native Americans on that list. So we are still underrepresented, you know, throughout these type of awards and recognition.
What do you want people to know about your grandfather?
Well, you know, just his contributions to sports itself. You know, without him, you know, he kind of paved the way for all minority athletes. So the NFL wouldn't be the NFL as it is today without him. So he contributed in so many ways. And as far as like Native American actors, you know, he back in the day where they hired, you know, a lot of Hispanics and white people to play Native American roles in the Cowboys and Indian movies, you know, he said he organized the Native groups and advocated for, you know, if you're going to have an Indian in these movies, let it be an Indian, you know, and not somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So his life work is not one of, you know, his agenda was not all about him and what he could benefit from sports and Hollywood. You know, his thoughts were always about his people, his Native people.
Mm. Anita, how often are you and your relatives asked to talk about your grandfather, Jim Thorpe, or go to events and make appearances?
Well, a lot more recently since, you know, in 2022 when his medals were restored and he is once again the sole winner of the 1912 Olympic men's decathlon and pentathlon. So, you know, that certainly kind of reinvigorated the Jim Thorpe legacy.
As a recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom from President Joe Biden. So just a huge honor, not only for the Thorpe family, but also the Sac and Fox Nation, as well as all of Native America. I think everybody relates to Jim Thorpe, the legend of Jim Thorpe, the history of Jim Thorpe. And he is certainly one of our greatest leaders and the most inspirational people, one of the very most inspirational people that we have in Native America. So we're back on the air, folks. Sorry about that power outage. But big thank you to our guests, Anita Thorpe, who joined us today, and also Wahb Gishag Rice, who talked about his latest novel, Moon of the Turning Leaves. So apologize for that power outage. Cut Anita Thorpe a little bit short, but we sure do appreciate her joining us to talk about her grandfather, Jim Thorpe, and his recent presentation with the Presidential Medal of Freedom by President Joe Biden. He received that award posthumously last week. And with that, we're going to wrap up the show now. Please join us again next week as we talk about the financial state of some of the country's wealthiest tribes. It'll be an interesting conversation. Hope you'll tune in. Until then, I'm your host, Sean Spruce. We'll be right back.
Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's Amerind.com.
My precious relatives, whether it's gardening, connecting to our land by walking, or powwow dancing, being active will help you sleep better. Be sure to enroll in a health insurance market plan for your overall healthcare needs. For more information, contact your Indian healthcare provider, visit healthcare.gov, or call 1-800-318-2596. A message from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.